Hello, and welcome to episode 92 of SMARTS, which, as you know, stands for Synthetic Metalloalloy Radioactively Threatens Supergirl.
Ooh.
Ooh. Thanks to Mom for that.
That was very good.
Yeah, I agree. So I am Julia Guglia of Internet Fame, a Dash podcaster, and with me is your co-host with the co-most. What does that even mean? I need to look that up. I don't think that's a real word. Shaking his head. Trevor, a.k.a. Rutiger, a.k.a. Q Podcaster, Extraordinaire Esquire the Third, Billington's Lee. Yes.
Right.
All right, I better stop this tragic intro and hand it off to you with the news.
Okay. So news. So it wouldn't be a show without weekly Ben Affleck Batman movie news update.
I know, he's like in it every week.
So there were rumors going around. So we talked about last week how Ben Affleck is now not going to direct the solo Batman movie. So Warner Brothers has been looking around for who will. I make it sound like they're like going through their pockets and looking in between the seat cushions to try to find a good director.
Joss Whedon?
There were rumors that Matt Reeves, who directed the most recent two Planet of the Apes reboot movies, which have gotten good reviews and done very well for... I'm not sure what studio is responsible for those. Actually, it might be Warner Brothers. I'm not sure. Was going to be tapped to do it. He also directed Cloverfield, which I really liked. You really like Cloverfield too. Got to start directing episodes of Felicity, apparently.
Oh, really?
For J.J. Abrams. There are rumors that he was going to do it, and then there were rumors that those talks had broken down. But just this afternoon, as we record this, Warner Brothers announced that Matt Reeves will, in fact, be directing the movie, and it will be titled The Batman, which is a title that
Excellent.
Had been bandied about. Ben Affleck had dropped it a couple of times, but people thought, well, maybe this just what he's using as a shorthand or something, because then he later had to, because he's good-natured about it and everything, but the fans apparently driving him crazy. The fans are like, he mentions one thing about this movie, about how it's going, how the script is going, or whatever. And
he's gonna have the coolest cape and cowl.
All of a sudden, it's all over Twitter. It's all over the blogs. People dissecting every word he says.
Oh,
so.
Boy.
He's been in the biz for a while. I think he'd be used to this kind of stuff by now. But I guess being in Daredevil or Armageddon or something wasn't quite the same level of publicity. So people, from what I've seen over this afternoon, people are generally happy with this pick. They feel like the last couple of Planet of the Apes movies, and Cloverfield for that matter, which is what I've seen, so that's really all I can base this guy on, has got a good style, and he's good at directing action movies that actually make you think and have a lot of heart to them.
Yep.
And like we talked about last time, I imagine, given that this project is so important to Ben Affleck, that he's also working on the script, he's obviously going to be starring in it, that I imagine he'll have a pretty firm hand as far as the direction of the movie also.
Yep.
So I imagine it'll almost be that they'll be co-directing it, perhaps not officially according to like Directors Guild rules or whatever, and credited as such, but I imagine that there'll be a lot of collaboration involved between them. So people seem to be generally happy with this. And of course, things could change because, I mean, the Flash movie has had like three directors now that have backed out. So of course, things could change again before it actually starts filming or after. But for now, this is the state of things.
Exciting.
Shortly after that was announced, there also news broke on the Hollywood Reporter that that Warner Brothers and Chris McKay, who directed the Lego Batman movie, which just came out, are developing a Nightwing movie.
Is it Lego?
No, just a regular Nightwing movie.
Just wanted to be sure.
so that's exciting. And of course, this is early days and may or may not happen, yada yada. But I would imagine that Warner Brothers could easily use the Batman movie or even Justice League or whatever to set up the presence of Dick Grayson in this universe.
Yeah.
And set up a Nightwing movie and then have that come out. And I think I think it's probably, I mean, all we know is that there was a Robin costume in the Batcave in Batman v Superman that was defaced by the Joker.
Yeah.
And everybody's pretty much assuming that was Jason Todd's costume.
Yeah.
And if that's the point we're at in the timeline, and given that Batman is older, et cetera, the odds of a 20-something Nightwing being out there are pretty good.
Yeah.
So there's not really a lot of legwork that needs to be done yet to set that up. Just have some offhanded mention in Justice League that Batman's worked with it's not the first time he's worked with partners or something like that.
Sure.
And then you have the Nightwing movie kind of speaks for itself. So
yeah, there you go.
And you could do a lot of interesting things with it. I mean, they could do actually something similar to what the comics are doing right now, with the classic Chuck Dixon run from the 90s, where you have him set on his own in Bloodhaven, and he's trying to take down the entrenched mob and corrupt police in Bloodhaven all the while, you know, setting up a life for himself, finding a new job, a love interest.
Yeah.
You know, they would almost be like a more traditional Batman movie in a way, kind of, than what the Ben Affleck Batman movie is probably going to be, because it has to follow after the Justice League movie and all this other stuff, where the Nightwing movie can kind of be a clean slate.
Yeah.
Back to basics.
Yeah.
Superhero movie. And of course, they could use a Nightwing movie to introduce potentially Batgirl or a new Robin into this universe. They could do all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And of course, who knows if this will even end up happening. Could be years away, but I think the Lego Batman movie has generally gotten good reviews. I'm not sure how well you can necessarily correlate the skill of directing a Lego movie to a live action movie. Obviously, there are some skills that carry over, but it's a very different kind of movie to be directing. So who knows if this guy's up to it, but it's exciting nonetheless that there's the potential for a Nightwing movie anyway.
Yep. That is exciting. I'm excited.
So news that received a bit more of a mixed reaction is that Warner Brothers is apparently in talks with, of all people, Mel Gibson to direct a sequel to Suicide Squad.
Say what?
Now, Mel Gibson, of course, has directed movies before.
Yes, he did a great job on The Patriot.
Some of which have been very well received and very acclaimed for his skills as a director. But he is, these days, a somewhat controversial figure for reasons outside of his skills at movie making.
Right.
So it would be a choice that would potentially lend itself to some bad PR.
Mm-hmm.
And especially since Suicide Squad received pretty lukewarm reactions in the first go-around, you would think that Warner Brothers might want more of like a clean win from a sequel, PR-wise. Like they'd want to get all their ducks in a row, have a director that the fans are excited about and just knock it out of the park.
Yeah.
This would seem like maybe starting off on the wrong foot from a PR perspective, but if they feel like he's got a really good take on it and he wants to do it, and he's obviously good at what he does, so I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where you'd have to sort of separate. He's by far not the most controversial figure in Hollywood in the movie industry, but still, it's one of those situations where you'd kind of have to separate, like you do when you watch, I don't know, like not to get too political or whatever or religious, but you watch like a Tom Cruise movie, you have to sort of set aside his personal beliefs from the movie that you're watching, you know, which would probably be even easier with a director that you perhaps disagree with than an actor who you actually have to watch on screen for 2.5 hours, you know. A lot of people go see a movie, they don't even know who directs it. Like, they don't pay attention to the credits or even stay for the credits necessarily. So I'm not sure it would even necessarily have an adverse effect on the box office. But it's definitely a bit of a weird thing PR-wise. But it could result in a good finished product, and who knows if he'll even end up doing it. But this isn't just a rumor. Like, his agent or whatever did confirm that these talks have happened. So they're definitely talking to him about it. We just don't know for sure yet. It's not as official as the Matt Reeves thing on the Batman.
Yeah.
So... We'll have to wait and see on that.
It's interesting. I don't even remember any projects that Mel Gibson has done recently, like especially since all of the
controversial... I don't follow his career that closely. I think he was in one of the new Expendables movies.
Oh, okay.
As like, along with every other washed up action star.
Ouch. Washed up?
Well, you know, you just say yourself, you can't think of anything memorable he's done probably since The Passion of the Christ?
That doesn't
maybe?
Mean... Oh, that's true, yeah. But yeah, nothing since then.
Yeah, and that was almost
like
15 years ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sure he's done stuff, but I'm just saying, like, I agree with you that he's sort of like, seems like he's kind of...
He's been out of the limelight.
Out of the limelight. Another movie news, the Han Solo movie, which is still untitled. I don't know if it's just going to be called Han Solo, a Star Wars story. I know what it's going to be called.
Has
started filming. There was a photo of the directors and the cast all huddled up in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
So you had Alden Ehrenreich, who's going to be playing Han Solo. You had Donald Glover in there sporting a cool beard.
Yep.
Woody Harrelson. We talked that he was
He's going to be
role,
the unnamed
so
mentor of some kind.
Emilia Clarke. I'm not sure we talked about the full cast. Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones and the most recent Terminator, most recent failed Terminator reboot. She's in there too. And a new fellow playing Chewbacca. I think Peter Mayhew is too ill, I think, to do it anymore.
Oh,
so they have it passing the torch to a new actor in the Chewbacca suit, which I think is the first confirmation that Chewbacca will be in the movie. But I think we all pretty much assume that.
Yeah.
I think Lando was more of a long shot than Chewie. And even that was kind of assumed until we got the Donald Glover casting.
Yeah, because we assume Han Solo's best friend is going to be there. But
we assume this will be
in a card game.
We assume this will be some combination of He meets Lando for the first time. He wins the Millennium Falcon. Yeah. He meets Chewie for the first time. Some combination of those plot
sort
points.
Of, yeah.
Yeah. Makes the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. It's probably going to be in there.
14 or 12.
So that started shooting. So that's exciting.
That is cool.
That's next year's movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's winter.
They should call it Flying Solo.
18.
They should call the film Flying Solo.
You're just going to keep throwing out those pun titles until I react to one of them.
Yes.
In TV news.
The day I shot first.
In TV news. Uh-huh. So we know that Marvel's Inhumans went from being a movie to being a TV special event. Remember where the first couple of episodes will premiere in theaters and IMAX and then it'll move to ABC.
That's cool.
So we have the first casting for that. So I don't know who this guy is, but even though you're terrible with names, you've seen some Game of Thrones, so you might know this guy.
Maybe.
So I'm going to try to pronounce his name. Ewan Rione apparently played Ramsay Bolton.
Oh, gross. Awesome.
On Game of Thrones.
We'll
be playing Maximus.
He's so good.
We'll be playing Maximus on The Inhumans. It's probably, I would say, like the second or third most important role in the show. He's not the lead. I would say Black Bolt, the king of the Inhumans, is probably the lead. Maximus is Black Bolt's. He's like the Orm, the Black Bolt's Aquaman. He's like his scheming court intrigue.
So he's
going to
be a bad guy.
Yeah, it's a bit more.
He starts out good guy,
that.
Goes a bad guy.
Well, he cares about his family and the kingdom of the Inhumans.
Yeah.
He just wants to be the one running it.
Ah.
So he's got his own series now in the comics. Like they've given him all sorts of shades of gray, but he's traditionally like an antagonist leaning character. And so the actor that played Ramsay Bolton on Game of Thrones is going to be playing him. I mean, that's the only casting news we have so far. I don't know who's going to be playing Black Bolt or Medusa or any of the other characters, but
super
exciting.
So he's
the first casting news.
I've seen him in other stuff as well, and I always dug him. He's really versatile. So this will be really fun. All right, go ahead.
We haven't talked a lot about the, I think we talked about when it was announced to be happening, but the live action X-Men TV show that Fox is doing, which is not going to focus on the X-Men per se, but will be set in like the X-Men movie universe and feature like more, I guess, not going to say third string, but like some side characters that the movies didn't really focus on.
Yeah.
But apparently will leave the door open for cameos from some movie characters. There's been a little bit of casting around that. I haven't brought it up on the show just because we don't normally talk about X-Men stuff as much, but I'm going to bring this up because it's an act that we're familiar with. So so Jamie Chung, who played Valerie Vale on Gotham, is going to be one of the leads in this new show.
Oh, cool.
She'll be playing the character Blink, who I'm not sure is a mutant that you're familiar with because you didn't see Days of Future Past.
I saw Doctor Who, Blink.
No, different character. The character was in Days of Future Past, played by a different actress, and now that character is going to be in this TV show.
Okay.
So I only mention it because we saw her on Gotham. It's an actor you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So they're filling out the cast for that, starting with her. I think there's only been one other casting announcement, actually, and they didn't even say what character that was for, just that he was a Native American character. They didn't even assign a name to it, so people are speculating what character that might be. But with this character, they said, no, it's going to be Blink, who's a character from the comic.
Cool.
She's basically like she teleports, but also she can like travel through dimensions or something. It's more than just a simple teleportation thing, I think. Anyway, it's been a long time since I read those comics. A little bit of comic book news. So there's a lot of Bane stuff happening right now in the Batman comics, right, with the I Am Bane storyline that we're reading right now.
Yep.
Apparently, DC is going to expand their Bane offerings starting in a couple of months. The original creators of Bane, Chuck Dixon, the writer that created him, and one of the artists that co-created the character, Graham Nolan, are coming back to write a 12-issue series called Bane Conquest, which will, I'm assuming, spin out of the current Bane storyline in the Batman comics.
Cool.
It'll be in continuity, so it'll be the same version of Bane. I don't know how closely it'll tie into what's happening right now. But this is the original creators who created him 20, 25 years ago, in the 90s anyway, for the Nightfall storyline where he was introduced and then broke Batman's back.
Yep.
Coming back to the character, no pun intended, and writing a new 12-issue year-long story form. So it's going to be called Bane Conquest, and it starts in a few months.
Very awesome.
Chuck Dixon hasn't gotten a lot of work from DC recently. I've mentioned him on the show. I mentioned him earlier as writing the classic Nightwing run. He wrote tons of great Batman comics during that 90s era, you know, the Bane Nightfall, Jean-Paul Valley, Azrael era, going all the way through to, say, like No Man's Land and stuff like that.
Yep.
But he wrote like 100 issues of Robin. He wrote dozens of issues of Nightwing. Really set those. And neither of those characters had had their own solo issues, solo series before until he wrote them. And now you can't really imagine a DC universe where there isn't a Nightwing series or a comic that stars Robin in it.
Yeah,
that was the first time that it happened. And he launched those characters. He created Bloodhaven and all those assorted characters. So he's great, but he hasn't gotten a lot of work from DC recently. Apparently, there was he got some bad press for his conservative views, which, as you can imagine, you know, most comics readers, being more of like the artsy liberal type, to paint with a very broad brush, don't subscribe to that particular brand of politics. And so DC got a bit of flack for continuing to employ him, which, I mean, I don't know. I can see both sides of that argument. Shouldn't his personal politics be his own business and not necessarily reflect on his employability by DC Comics? Maybe, maybe not. But at any rate, he got less and less work from DC over the years. But now apparently they want to work with him again on this series. So anyway, he's an excellent writer. He created the character, so he knows Bane front to back. So I'm looking forward to this. I think it'll be a good series.
Nice.
One other little bit of comic news. Mm-hmm. So we're reading all the Young Animal titles.
Yep.
We're reading Doom Patrol, Shade the Changing Girl,
yep.
Mother Panic,
yep.
and Cave Carson Has a Cybernetic Eye.
Yep.
So far those have been it, those four titles. They're expanding the line slightly in a few months with the first Young Animal miniseries, which will focus on the character of Forager. It's going to be called Bug, The Adventures of Forager.
Nice.
You may remember Forager from some of the cartoons. When they went to Apocalypse and New Genesis, he was the guy with like the white shirt and the red helmet that helped Batman and Wonder Woman when they were being attacked by like a giant worm on New Genesis. And he's like, oh, I'm just an unworthy bug. All the gods live up on the city. And at the end, Highfather was like, no, you have earned your place among us.
Yes, I remember that.
That's Forager. He is a member of the
that's why
the
bug, they call it
the
called
bug race on New Genesis. Except in the comics, it was revealed that he actually was a New Genesian. He actually was from Supertown, the city on New Genesis. But he had been raised among the bug. He had been exiled and raised among the bug people or something. So he actually did deserve to live in the city. But his allegiance was with the bug people, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, he's an interesting character, but sort of like a third tier character that Jack Kirby created for the whole New Gods mythos.
Right.
But he's been a fan favorite. He's shown up here and there. So he's going
to remember you got such a kick when we saw him there.
So he's going to be getting his own miniseries from Young Animal. I'm really thrilled with the creators that are doing it. It's going to be a family affair. Mike Allred, who I'm trying to think of, you haven't read anything he's done, but I mean, he created, I don't think you've heard of Madman. He co-created the iZombie series, which has now been adapted to the CW. He's done a ton of indie stuff. He's right up there with, trying to think of other indie creators you might know, but like the Dave Sim, who created Cerebus, or Jeff Smith, who created Bone, or the Eastman and Laird, who created the Ninja Turtles. Like Mike Allred is up with them in terms of like indie comics icons from the past 20 years. His wife, Laura Allred, colors a lot of his stuff.
Cool.
And his brother, Lee Allred, will often co-write projects with him. So the three of them are the ones doing the series.
Oh, cool.
So it's going to be Mike Allred, Lee Allred, and Laura Allred on this series.
That's
six issues starring Forager.
Wow.
So you can be
guaranteed. That's going to be a
lot of fun. You can be guaranteed it's going to be sort of a throwback in terms of tone and style, probably like a little classic, kind of like the Commandy series, I guess, that we're reading right now, in terms of being like a throwback to the old Jack Kirby stuff. Over the top, colorful, old-fashioned comic stuff, I would imagine. But also with the Allreds in there, it's probably going to be a little subversive, a little trippy, probably. But I'm looking forward to that. I think something like that, the idea of having Forager in a Young Animal series, when those series right so far have skewed very adult and kind of dark in a way, definitely subversive. So I it's an interesting mix to have a Forager series of all things from Young Animal, but...
Yeah.
But I think it's upon further contemplation, it's a pretty good match given how off the wall it's going to be, how non-mainstream it's going to be.
Right.
So that's happening too.
That's
all of our news.
Wow. That's a big load of news. And as we're recording on Thursday, usually we record on Sundays, but again, scheduling stuff. That's already happening, and it's only half of the news that we usually get.
That's right. Well, except it's been a week and a half since we recorded last. So
that's
like
fair.
A week and a half's worth of news.
That's true.
So comics of the week.
Comic of the week.
So what's your comic of the week this week?
My comic of the week this week is Odyssey of the Amazons issue number 2. It's super good. And yeah, it was technically last week's, but again, we're lumping a week and a half. But basically, short version is that I love the art, I love the storytelling, and I love feminism. So those three reasons are why I chose it for my comic of the week.
I'm enjoying it too. I find the artist has done stuff I've read before. Did some Batman Beyond stuff. His stuff can be a little weird for me sometimes. The characters are sort of, I don't know. It's hard for me to describe. His style, the way he renders the characters, can sometimes be a little off-putting to me. I didn't think it was a really good match for Batman Beyond. If you can picture a Batman Beyond comic drawn in that style.
Yes.
It was sort of a weird match for me. It works better here for me because it's more gritty. You know, the characters are down in the dirt fighting with swords and dragons and stuff. So it works better for me here. The writer, I agree. It's well-written so far. This is, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, but Kevin Grievox is how it's
written.
He's sort of like a triple threat or a quadruple threat because he's a writer, he's an actor, he did some voices for Young Justice.
Oh, cool.
Actually, he voiced Black Beetle, if you know, the really deep thunderous voice that Black Beetle had.
Oh, right.
Wow. He's a director also, I think, so he does a whole bunch of things. I'd never read anything he's written before, but so I'm enjoying this. I mean, the basic premise is that this is a group of Amazons led by Hesia, who's a I'm not sure how to describe her physically. I'm trying not to offend anybody. Dark-skinned. I mean, I'm not sure she's African, right? Or she's certainly not African-American, so I'm not sure. I'm tripping over my PC here. But a dark-skinned Amazon warrior who was introduced, I think, during the Superman-Wonder Woman run by Charles Soule a couple of years ago in the New 52. She has been tasked with Hippolyta to travel the world and collect Amazons of different ethnicities and tribes that I guess diverged from the main line of Amazons thousands of years ago and bring them all back to Themyscira so the Amazon people can be whole again. She's got a large entourage of Amazons they're a colorful bunch. At times I have trouble remembering which is which because they introduce a lot of characters that I'm not familiar with. And again, it's easier to distinguish them based on their costumes than anything else because facially they all kind of look.
Well, they wear a lot of armor too. Yeah, it's not like you'll see their faces a lot of times.
Which is a bit of a beef I have with it. But it's good. And they've lost some of their number. They're out on a quest to rescue them right now. They've met up with the classic DC adventure character, Viking Prince.
That was a surprise. But this last issue, that was actually super nice because it was, and again, I mean, there are tons of feminist stories that have been told and probably will continue to be told throughout time. But I really love the elements of this interaction because he shows them respect that he would defer to any warriors. And there are some in his army that regard them as women first and warriors like barely. But I like the interactions that they have, and they sort of explain the other side of the culture. And one page I remember is she made reference to Hades or something, and he came back with who? She said, never mind. And then he says something along the lines of, I slept like the, I don't remember, like some, I don't know, Sonorous or whoever their Norse god of sleep is.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of jarring for me to see the Norse gods referred to in a DC comic because he starts talking about Odin and Thor and Ragnarok or something.
Right.
Like, this is weird. This feels like this should be in a Marvel comic. The DC stuff should be
but
all about
Zeus. But
it's
Norse lore.
No, I know. Yeah. Well, I mean,
and it's super well researched. I appreciate the writer for that because they have such a deep connection to ancient history, ancient mythology.
And both Marvel and DC have always had a sort of an interesting relationship with mythology and religions in their comics where every religion is kind of true because you can have an angel. You can have characters sent to hell, but also meeting Zeus and also having the Norse Ragnarok happening. And it's kind of like all these things are true, but none of them are true. It's always been a weird sort of tightrope that they've walked.
I think it's awesome. I'm only getting introduced to all of comic books in general, but I absolutely love it. This is one interaction where they really do come from such different cultures and ancient history mythologies that they bring with them and they carry with them all the time, and having them talk and sometimes, you know, share those bits of information is just so much fun. And
yeah, it is good. I think it's a 6-issue miniseries.
I love a good Odyssey story. I read the Iliad and the Odyssey in school when I was a We Bern, and it's stuck. I love it.
It's interesting that DC is publishing what is essentially a second Wonder Woman title. I think it shows that the main Greg Rucker written bi-weekly Wonder Woman title must be selling quite well.
Yep.
Because there is I guess initially you had Wonder Woman was starting in Sensation Comics and she had her own eponymous title, but it's been a long time since there's been regularly more than one Wonder Woman or Wonder Woman family title coming out a month.
And Hesia is such a great protagonist. I mean, she's super strong. She's smart. She's brave.
She's good. She was introduced as kind of a mentor to Wonder Woman in the New 52 run, where she didn't
live on Themyscira anymore. I remember hearing her name before this.
She was like living in London, running like a martial arts school or something, and Wonder Woman would go to her for advice. Mm. She was an older Amazon, so now this is like her in her prime, I guess.
That's cool. That's so nice. And this like predates, obviously, with Norse mythology. And the character, tell me more about this character that the blonde-haired dude that we were just talking about.
The Viking Prince?
Yeah, the Viking Prince.
Well, I've never read a Viking Prince comic. I just know that he is a classic Joe Kubert illustrated adventure hero back from the time when you would have Viking Prince and Enemy Ace and all these other different genres of... You'd have war titles and sword and sorcery and adventure and mysticism and horror and all these things that these days the main company's output is almost all superheroes, so you don't see as much anymore. But the main thing that I know him from is that one Justice League Unlimited episode where Grodd was telling Luthor the story of the Viking Prince, and it was done in these beautifully almost painted, but I think they were probably done from pencils and colors that Bruce Timm himself illustrated, trying to do a Joe Kubert style. But to me, that looks like a weird melding of Bruce Timm and Joe Kubert telling the story of Prince John, the Viking prince, who fell in love with a Valkyrie and wanted to marry her, but Odin would allow it, but only if he was cursed to live forever until he could find a warrior's death or something. And so he's lived for however many hundreds or thousands of years, you know, trying to find a glorious death, but has never been able to find it. And so he sort of travels the world as a wandering warrior, cursed by his love and all this other stuff. So, and so that was the premise of the series. And they've brought him back, you know, periodically here and there. This is the first time I've read a comic with him. I mean, it might have been in like way deep in the back in Crisis on Infinite Earths or something that spans the whole universe. But
didn't they introduce the Valkyries at the very end of the last issue?
I think so.
I think so, too. They flew in on horseback, so on Pegasus horseback. Yes.
Maybe. I think,
I might be conflating, but I think that's right. Anyway, so yeah, we might get to see the blossoming of that. So maybe. Who knows? But overall, beautiful art, beautiful story. I love it. So that's why it's my comic of the week. How about you? What'd you pick?
So I picked from last week, Nightwing number 15.
Do.
So I really enjoyed this issue. This was a low-key issue.
Oh, it was so nice.
Following off the whole... it's kind of an epilogue. I think it's actually built on the cover as an epilogue to the, you know, Return to Bloodhaven arc. So, so Nightwing has returned to Bloodhaven for the first time, I guess, because this version of Nightwing or Nightwing with this set of memories or however you want to parse it has never lived in Bloodhaven before. But of course, we the readers know that, you know, that was his main base of operations for like 10 years.
This is the beginning parts of
So he's going there for the first time. He's setting up shop. It's a different kind of Bloodhaven. The conception of Bloodhaven in the old comics would be that imagine if this is like Gotham's ugly stepsister city, like it was even worse than Gotham.
Wow.
Like this would be Gotham if it had no Batman and no Jim Gordon, basically. Like corruption was rampant. It was all run by the mob and all the cops were corrupt. Like, and so Nightwing basically took it upon himself to clean up Bloodhaven the way that Batman had cleaned up Gotham.
Wow.
Here they've twisted it a little bit. Like there's references that he probably used to be that bad, but it's now they've sort of twisted it where the city is becoming gentrified, and the city elders are trying to prop it up as like a touristy place with new PR campaigns and billboards and casinos and stuff like that.
Right.
But all the seedy stuff is still happening under the surface, but it's been sort of like papered over with this veneer of civility, you know?
Charming.
So it's a bit of a different twist on the city, but so, and the other interesting thing that the writer has done that I almost said Tom King, but it's not Tom King. Tim Seeley. The Tim Seeley has done is bring back a lot of classic Nightwing foes, largely from the era when he was in Bloodhaven, but introduce them as this group of retired, trying to be reformed supervillain support group called the Runoffs.
Oh, okay.
So you have characters like Mouse and Stallion, and then a couple that he created, like the woman that I'm going to be talking about in a second.
Right.
whose supervillain name I forget, but she was basically
Defacer.
Defacer, yeah, spray paint stuff. So you bring back some classic Nightwing villains. And then this issue also, there were, because this issue jumps forward, I'll describe the premise in a second, but it sort of spans a few months. And there are references in some of the dialogue mm-hmm. to like some classic Nightwing adventures kind of happening off page.
Well, this...
So Nightwing mentions that he fought some British assassin, this female British assassin with long blonde hair. That's Lady Vic. That's a classic Nightwing foe from the old Bloodhaven run. So, you get
so you're getting even deeper references than I am.
He's setting up in
these.
Bloodhaven. And now we're kind of seeing like, we can imagine that a lot of his classic Bloodhaven adventures are kind of happening behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Like we're not necessarily seeing them again, but he's accruing that history again, which is kind of a cool thing for the fans. But anyway, the main premise of this issue is that a woman that is a former supervillain herself that was running this supervillain support group when we met her in the last arc, Shan Tsang, aka the Defacer.
Yep.
She and Nightwing have struck up a bit of a rapport, and at the start of this issue, they start going out.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue spans, I think, a couple of months.
Yeah, 60-something days.
In their relationship,
yep.
where we see them get to know each other, we see them have their fights, we see them introduced to each other's parents in a way. Well, I guess Sean doesn't meet Bruce, but we see Dick meet her parents and get on with them.
Yeah.
And we see Dick talking to Alfred and Bruce about her, which is kind of the closest you would get to.
And she's also getting used to the idea that this is a longer term, more serious relationship than she was.
Yeah, and
even.
We learn more about her. Nice. We learn how she feels about her art, how she feels about her past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why she wants to stay in Bloodhaven, why she tries to push him away at times, and how she's fighting to overcome those tendencies on her part. And at the end of the issue, I mean, without spoiling too much, she's seemingly put in peril.
Yep.
I don't think that they're going to kill her off because that's such a cliche. And also, I feel like you wouldn't have spent this much time building her up just to take her off the board. So I think she's going to be in peril, but I think that it's going to be okay, at least in the short term. I would imagine anyway. It doesn't seem like this writer's style to just fridge her like right out of the gate.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's a testament to the skill of the writer that just in... I mean, we've seen her in the previous arc, but we didn't really learn very much about her aside from the fact that she met Dick when he was Robin and they kind of shared a moment, you know, because they were roughly the same age, but then she got taken off to jail and we learned a bit more about her. But in this issue, we really get to know her. And over the course of just 20 pages, we become, or at least I did, become invested enough in their relationship that when she's in danger
too.
At the end, you want it to be 2 weeks later so you can make sure that she's okay. And that's no mean feat.
No.
And 20 pages of comics, not even 20 pages of prose where you can pack a lot more information in there. 20 pages of comics, which are largely a visual medium, that you can become so invested in this relationship.
Yep.
And Dick has been in dozens of romantic relationships, and so you kind of...
Actually, that becomes a plot point, doesn't he? Because he talks to, like, no less than... Two, probably, I'm forgetting
yeah,
one.
Yeah, he talks to
Barbara
ex-girlfriends,
and Starfire. Yeah.
Barbara Starfire, who's the third?
I don't remember, but I think there's a third.
Two ex-girlfriends that he owns.
Those are the ones I remember, but isn't there one more
they
rattling
could have,
around somewhere?
They could have Hunter show up or something. They could have Helena show up because they were together for a little bit. But
anyway.
I mean, Nightwing has had... He's got this relationship as like the lover boy of the DC universe through no fault of his own. It's not like he discards women or whatever. He genuinely cares about them. It's just that bad things happen, like James Bond, you know, except without the sexism. And so you're like, you kind of know that this is probably going to be temporary. Like 50 years from now, I don't think these two characters are going to be married with kids. You know, this is probably going to be a temporary thing that this writer, when a new writer comes on the book, they'll forget this character ever existed. But
I sort of resent that summation. I mean, obviously, the way that this book or this issue made you feel about the relationship, you could totally see that they could wind up together.
Well, I mean, characters rarely wind up together.
Yeah,
They even tried to get rid of the whole Lois and Clark thing in the New 52, only to bring it back recently by bringing back the classic Superman.
Because they're such an iconic
couple. No relationship is really permanent in comics, and new characters so rarely stick around these days. It's all about bringing back the classic characters. New characters very rarely find purchase with readers. Especially new love interest.
That's true, but I'm just saying.
I only mention it in terms of like the fact that I know that this character probably isn't going to stick makes it all the more impressive that I became invested in the relationship.
Yes.
Because since I know going in, it's probably just going to be a temporary thing.
Maybe. Yeah, you read page one thinking, oh, this is just going to be, you know, the just something. But then by the end of it, you really want, you're rooting for the couple. You're rooting for both of them, and you're invested in what both of them are up to. And. Yeah. No, it was a super good issue. Good choice.
So should we move on to your quiz?
I am ready. I've been studying, I've been reading and forgetting things. But okay. That last part might not matter.
So this week, I'm going to quiz you about Acquisitions Incorporated.
Oh my gosh. Oh, you need to explain to everybody because we haven't talked about Acquisitions Incorporated on this podcast.
It's kind of hard to explain. Acquisitions Incorporated is a series of Dungeons & Dragons campaigns that are filmed and released as podcasts and web videos where the players are Mike and Jerry from Penny Arcade and typically Scott Kurtz from PvP and a rotating cast of fourth chairs.
You've had Will Wheaton, you've had...
Well, hold on, because now you might be getting into things that I'm going to quiz
you
about.
Okay. Interesting.
But it's basically become a zany off the wall, almost a parody of a traditional Dungeons & Dragons campaign.
It's fantastic.
As played by these cartoonists.
And the Dungeon Master and has always
campaigns,
been Chris Perkins.
The campaigns are released typically on YouTube and done live at PAX events around the world.
Which, by the way, we're going to be going to PAX this year and we will totally be recording... If not a mini-sode, maybe a mega-sode,
yeah, we'll have
maybe
to do something about that.
So that's
the premise.
Okay, I'm so excited.
So you ready for the quiz?
I am ready. This is going to be fun.
All right, so number one. Uh-huh. When was the first Acquisitions Incorporated adventure?
Oh, that's... What?
What year?
What year? 2006?
No, 2008.
All right.
All right, number two.
Uh-huh.
What are the first and last names of the three founding members? By which I mean the characters, not the people that play them.
Omen Dran.
Right.
Binwin Bronzebottom.
Right.
And Jim Dark Magic.
Correct.
Anybody in the audience listening right now, if you have time, you guys, if you don't know these people, you should probably be wanting to look them up right about now.
All right. Number three.
Uh-huh.
What is the name of the DM for almost all?
Oh, Chris Perkins.
Correct.
Yay.
Number four.
Uh-huh.
List three Acquisitions Incorporated interns.
Their characters.
Not the people.
A.O. Phil.
Right.
Viari.
Right.
And the Ranger. I only saw one episode with her in it. She's Megan. I don't know her name. Okay, well, there was another one then. How about something like Milford or Milden or something? No, there was another one that was like, but Chris Perkins played him. No, I can't do that. I can't do it. I don't know the third one.
Well, the other one I was looking for was Morgan Webb's character, Morgaine.
Morgaine. Really? She's awesome. Okay.
All right. Number five.
Wait, so do I get like 2/3 of a point?
Yes.
Oh, all right.
Number five.
Uh-huh.
Name Omen's two sisters.
Oh wow. Portentia.
Right.
And Organa?
No. Auspicia.
Auspicia. All right, so I get half a point on that one.
Number six.
Uh-huh.
Binwin's family was disgraced by what rival dwarvish clan?
Oh, I can't remember that. What was it? The Bilgewaters? I don't know. I can't remember.
The Amber Shards.
The Amber Shards. No, I would not have been able to remember that. When was that?
It was referenced in some of the ones we were watching over the weekend. That's the only time you would have seen it. You haven't watched or listened to that campaign
section
yet. That was the third quote-unquote season, I think.
Oh, okay.
It was the one where Aelfel fell into the Pit of Acid. And that was an Amber Shard manor.
I haven't reached that point yet. I'm only now catching up to the very first podcast release before they even started recording. Anyway.
Number seven.
Mm-hmm.
What artifact allowed Binwin to have a random magical effect on his target?
Wand of Wonder.
Correct.
Okay.
Number eight.
Uh-huh.
Where is Jim's family from?
The New Hampshire Dark Magics.
Haven't you heard
of you? Yay. Uh-huh.
Number nine.
Yes.
What is the name of Jim's put-upon cousin?
Oh, I tried looking this up the other day. We were talking about this the other day, and you went through the trouble of looking it up and quizzing me on it. You great pink meanie. Cecil?
No, it's similarly foppish, though.
Yeah, it's Cyril?
No, it's Percival.
Percival!
Or Percy, as you would often call him.
Percy. Ugh, yes.
All right.
So good.
Number 10.
Yes.
Viari is the player character for what real-life novelist?
Patrick... Please find the last name. Brain. Wand of Wonder. Brain. Patrick. Rufus.
Well, close enough.
Rothfuss. Yes, Rothfuss.
Patrick Rufus.
I like redlined the microphone. Sorry about blowing out your eardrums, everybody. Okay.
So very good.
Oh, that was the whole quiz?
That was it. That
I was ready for more.
That was 10 questions.
All right. So I nailed like 7 and
yeah,
so one
like third
or something.
Something like that.
7 and a third.
I'm do the advanced math right now. Very good.
Yay. That was a great quiz.
So should we move on to our TV shows?
Yes, I'm ready.
Briefly, we always talk about Justice League Action.
Mm-hmm.
So this one was Timeshare, it was called. This was a fun adventure
yes.
where Batman and Blue Beetle are thrown back in time
that was a lot of fun.
By Kronos. To Batman's first night on the job.
Yep.
And there's a lot of...
His key case.
There's a lot of fun nods to Batman the Animated Series.
Yes. I am darkness. I am the night. I am Batman.
Close.
Well.
And then, of course, standing on the rooftop.
Yes.
With the, and everything from the red skies in the background to the Danny Elfman music, which technically...
With the lightning bolt in the background.
Yeah. I would have preferred if it was the Shirley Walker theme, but of course, Danny Elfman's theme was used in the opening.
Yep.
So I'll give him that. it was a lot of fun, and having the characters bounce off each other. You know, Kevin Conroy is Batman, and I forget the name of the kid that plays Blue Beetle in this. He's also the guy that voices him in the animated movies these days.
I actually looked this up.
Forget his name, but he's very good too. His amazement at how bad Batman was at his job back in the early days, and how overly dramatic he was a lot of fun to watch.
And he relished the opportunity to throw some of Batman's criticisms about his performance back.
And of course, and the running gag of Kronos not remembering his name, and they even managed to work in the name of Blue Beetle Scarab, which is Khaji Da, which I enjoyed because usually the other media stuff doesn't bother to.
Young Justice
did a lot of stuff with the fact that his Scarab is actually like a separate entity that he actually has to befriend and convince to be on the good guy side when the alien race that created it comes back to town. But even there, where that was a major plot point for the whole season, they didn't bother giving it a name. So I do enjoy that they worked that in there.
Yeah.
So Star Wars Rebels, this one was Legacy of Mandalore.
Yes,
I enjoyed this
good.
One not as much as the previous one, which is kind of was high bar to live up to.
That was a high bar to live up to, but it was also very emotionally charged. This was more about the payoff from that episode. I felt like it was good.
The family
follow-up.
Family drama stuff.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it. I don't really have a lot to say about it. I mean, it was interesting. I wonder.
Good episode, great follow up.
Do you think we're going to see Sabine again this season? You think they'll go a few episodes without seeing her, but then the Mandalorians will swoop in to save the day in the finale or something
she's
like that?
She's part of the cast. She's a great big part of the family as well. I'm sure that we'll see her sooner rather than later. And not only that, but I actually think that they're going to clean up Mandalore. And, well, I mean, it's a. Not cartoon, but what's the correct way to animated series, I suppose? With a medium like this, you kind of get a swift plot wrap on some of the key points. So what typically would take months, maybe years of work to restore Mandalore and politically reset everything onto a better path and maybe then be in a position to fight the Empire as a planet, they're probably going to do in just a couple episodes behind the scenes and then maybe rejoin the rest of the family with kind of a better position to put Mandalore on the map with the rebellion.
Maybe.
Yeah, I have faith.
All right.
We'll definitely see her again. I mean, she's a cast member. Like, we're going to see her again.
So, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Uh-huh.
I feel like, so we have two episodes here, but I feel like last week's episode was really overshadowed by this week's episode. But last week's episode was The Man Behind the Shield.
Yeah.
And it was all about, really, I guess you could say it was all about our guys waging an assault on the Superior and Ada's stronghold to rescue May and Director Mace. You had the big final confrontations. You had, you know, Daisy versus the Superior, and then you had Coulson versus the Superior, and Mace got to do some stuff, and he tried to escape, and everybody came in and rescued them, and then you find it at the end, of course, that some of them have been replaced by LMDs.
Yeah, that was a great reveal.
And so that was a really good episode. That was kind of like a standard action episode, but it led into this week's episode, which was called Self-Control.
Yes.
And I feel like this might be the best episode of the show
far. It was crazy. Like
I think a lot of people put this one up against the previous favorite, and a lot of people love the early stuff in mid-season one with the right after the Hydra reveal.
Yeah, that was great.
Those were some good episodes. And then the other one that a lot of people look back on as being a highlight is the episode, I forget what it was called, but the one that was, the title was just However Many Days, and it was the episode that was all Simmons
on the
alien
planet. Yep.
But that was a very off-format episode, and so it was memorable for its how different it was from the and its quality, but memorable for how different it was from the standard episode.
Right.
Whereas this, in terms of subject matter and the characters that we're dealing with and the settings and so on, was very much a standard episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but it was just so well done.
Right.
Everything from the acting to... So this was Jed Whedon, who's one of the showrunners and has written or co-written many episodes of the show,
right.
Wrote this one. Solo, I mean, with The Room, but sole credited writer, but also directed it. And this is his first directing effort, at least the first that he's been credited with. And I feel like this was such a well-directed episode because everything had a very interesting look to it. It wasn't shot like a standard episode of the show. There were a lot of memorable shots, the shots were framed in interesting ways, or a lot of interesting lighting effects going on, a lot of cool visual trickery. The stunts were executed really well. The special effects were great. There were so many great acting moments too. The scene between Fitz and Simmons where both of them are trying to convince the other that they're not the LMD and they're both breaking down, and you can, like, there's so much unspoken and between the characters. And then you find it that Fitz is the LMD, and she has to basically stab him to death, even though he looks and acts exactly like the man she loves. Her whole reaction after that, the scene where she and Daisy find each other, and they convince each other that they're not LMDs, and they're so relieved to have found each other. Just so many great acting
character
moments. The bit with May at the end, where the May LMD sacrifices herself because she's in a way more human than. She's more May than the Coulson LMD is Coulson.
Yes.
Because she was, you know, for all the reasons, that the circumstances of her creation and her mission.
And those interactions are, it's so good.
And you really feel like, so this is the final part of this. For some reason, I don't know, we always need to come up with weird terms. So we've talked about how this season is broken up into three arcs. So there was the Ghost Rider arc, then there was the LMD arc, and then the last arc, people are calling Agents of Hydra. I guess because we're seeing in the world, the framework, that Hydra is ascendant there, right? As was hinted at the end. Whether that'll be the official name that they put on the title card or not, I don't know. But so this is the conclusion of the second pod, which is what they're calling. I don't know why they don't just call them arcs or mini seasons or whatever. They got to call them pods, and people always can come up with weird words for things these days. But it felt like a much more of a cliffhanger than the bridge between the Ghost Rider stuff and the LMD stuff. So the common thread across all of them has been Ada and the Darkhold and Radcliffe. So that stays true. But this was a lot more of a, I feel like the third arc is going to be much more of a culmination of everything the season's been leading up to, and not a third discrete standalone arc. But you really feel like huge things are happening. The other thing I like, that I don't normally notice these things. I don't always notice these things because I feel like, not to pat myself on the back too much, that I'm fairly gender blind when I'm watching TV shows. I'm not like, oh wow, there's a lot of great female characters in this episode. Like, I don't
leave it to me. Don't worry,
really,
I got
notice
you.
That. But I did see someone comment about this episode, and in thinking about it, it's definitely true. Like, this was such a great female-led episode, right? Like, every major character, like Coulson, Mac, Fitz, they were all off the stage, right? Like, they had the LMDs that were in there that were impersonating them.
Right.
But when we think about it, who were the heroes of this episode? Well, it was Simmons and Daisy, right?
Yeah.
Who was the villain of this episode? It was Ada, right?
Right.
Who did the big sacrifice play at the end? It was the May LMD.
Right.
Even the sort of the S.H.I.E.L.D. interns that they rounded up, the main one that we've seen a bunch of times, she's female too. I forget her name. Agent Piper, I think her name is. So
that was a great moment too. Like, she was literally about to defend her team and stab poor Simmons, who she thought was an LMD, who wasn't really an LMD.
But this was such a great, not to say there was a showcase for the female characters, because that feels like forced and contrived, but in a very natural way that this show has so many great female characters.
This is what TV
ought to be. The circumstances
just
happened to line up that they were all given great moments in this episode, and the male characters basically spent the episode asleep.
Right.
But the other thing I thought was interesting about this was that they really, so we talked before the season started about how the show's been moved to an hour later time slot, and how that'll let them do more mature subject matter.
Right.
I feel like the Ghost Rider arc Yeah, like they had the characters getting burned and they talked about hell and stuff. But it didn't really feel that much. I mean, you could argue some of the action scenes were a bit more violent, had a bit more blood in them. I didn't really notice that much of a shift. But this episode, there were scenes where you were actually finding it hard to watch.
I really actually.
There were this episode was like, you know, the subtitle for this episode could have been like wrists in danger, right? Yeah. Wrist risks. Were there in this episode, like, you had Fitz slitting his own wrists, Ada slitting both of Ratcliffe's wrists, and didn't another character got their throat cut, too, right? Like, there was a lot of slitting in this episode.
Yeah, don't remind me.
It was like, you know, a lot of wrists. But that's bad. That's just, hopefully this doesn't sound too sociopathic of me, but I could watch characters get shot, blown up, punched.
Well, I mean, you're such a big fan of The Walking Dead, and I legitimately had to stop watching it because
something about having your throat or your wrist cut is just like that's just icky on a different level. Like that and eyeballs, that and like eyeball horror, or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if ever see you going to inject something into an eyeball,
don't even put those visuals in anybody's head.
Yeah,
come on.
That's bad.
I know that I'm not the only one out there.
I guess Radcliffe's gone now, right? I mean, we'll continue to see him, I'm sure, in the framework.
Yeah.
So the setup for this episode is that all the characters either
maybe even an LMB.
Either forcefully, in the case of, you know, Coulson, Mac, Fitz, or by their own choosing, like Radcliffe, and maybe we'll even see the woman who was the basis for Ada again in the framework, right?
Yeah.
And then at the end of the episode, heroically on the part of Simmons and Daisy, put themselves in the framework to bring the others out.
Yeah.
They know who they are and what their real lives are. All the other characters presumably will only know their memories within the framework, these new lives that have been constructed for them.
That was a heck of a closer.
Interesting, though, is where the characters all are. So we see Daisy wakes up. She's seemingly an agent still because they say she gets a text like, you know, we've got a mission for you. Come in and bring your boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so she thinks that in this reality, Lincoln is still alive and they're together.
Yeah.
But
we see
the photo on the desk nearby that she's together with Grant Ward, who we know Brett Dalton is returning for the last third of the season as Ward. We see that Fitz is like Tony Stark now, basically.
Yeah.
Simmons is seemingly dead. Because we saw her grave.
Yep, we did.
Mac, which needs
an explanation.
Mac seems to be living a peaceful home life, and all indications are that his daughter is alive. Because we saw
Why
him.
Why would Simmons wish herself dead?
Well, see, this is what I'm going to get to in a second, but let's just finish the roundup.
Uh-huh.
Coulson is seemingly like a professor or something.
Okay.
Living a low-key life away from being a spy, which is kind of what it seems like he wanted. And May seems like she's a bigwig at S.H.I.E.L.D., only to have it pull out and we see, oh, that's the Triskelion. We haven't seen that since Winter Soldier or Winter Shoulder. and then it pulls out and instead of the S.H.I.E.L.D. logo on the side of the building, there's a Hydra logo. And so you think to yourself, this doesn't make any sense. Like, the characters are put in there and they only get to change one thing, one regret that they had.
Yep. And live out the rest of their lives.
Does May regret not being evil? Does Simmons regret being alive? Like, that doesn't make any sense. But they've said in interviews, and I feel like it's between the lines in the episode, you have to read it, is that every time a new person is put into the framework, Ada said, like, she has to reset the whole scenario. Because one person's decision might affect everything else in there.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, there are going to be regrets that people are going to want to take back as more and more people are added in there that might conflict with each other.
Right.
Right. Or that might cause a butterfly effect. Right.
Right.
Like every decision someone makes affects the whole rest of the framework. That's why they have to reset it every time.
Yep.
So even if May didn't wish to be the head of Hydra or Simmons didn't wish to be dead, what if somebody else in the framework wished that, you know, they hadn't missed that car that day?
Right.
And in turn, that means that Simmons was hit by, like,
there's
a butterfly effect going on. So the characters, even though they all got to change one thing about their lives, where they ended up might not be where they would want to end up.
Yeah, exactly.
If you follow me.
Yeah.
So the world is going to be very different. And so they seemingly Hydra is a big thing. We don't know if they're evil and they've taken over the world or whether like Alexander.
It's like a benevolent
Alexander
incorporation
Pierce's
there.
Plan from Winter Soldier went off without a hitch. And now the world thinks that they're good because even though they killed all those people in Winter Soldier, whatever. Who knows? Apparently they've said that they also want to use this to do some, I don't know, some political commentary about the state of the world and the state of the country right now.
Yep.
So I think we're going to see some of the Hydra stuff, you know, the sacrificing freedom for security and you know, freedom, personal freedoms being trampled on, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, comics and superhero comics have always been political. And a lot of people these days don't like to think about that, depending on the side of the argument they fall on. But one of the bedrock images of the Marvel Universe was Captain America punching Hitler on the cover of his first comic before America entered World War II. So these characters have always been political. And so I feel like I'm not going to give the show any flack for wanting to do a little bit of subtle political commentary, you know, in their fourth season. I feel like they've earned it. So I think it's going to be interesting. Now, whether the whole final seven episodes of the show are going to be set in the framework or whether only some of them will and then they'll bust out. I feel like, though, that we don't know if the show's getting another season or not. It hasn't been picked up like all the CW shows have, but the CW always gives early renewals to all their stuff. So it doesn't necessarily mean anything bad. And I've seen some experts say that, well, the way that Marvel is positioning the show and the way ABC's ratings are right now, it's likely to get a fifth season, but it's still up in the air. But I feel like from what I've read that the last third of the season is going to be kind of like a love letter to the fans.
Yeah.
That there's going to be elements, maybe characters that we haven't seen in years that might still be alive in the framework. There's going to be a lot of stuff they can do, a lot of callbacks to early stuff, resolving a lot of plot threads and bringing back classic characters that fans miss. So I feel like this last arc is really positioned to be like a culmination of the, not just the season, but the whole 4 years of the show. And then if they get another year, they get another year. But I feel like that's the way they're kind of going into it. So it should be interesting to see. But anyway, I've talked about it enough, but I don't know. I really think that this was maybe my favorite episode, and it's interesting that it wasn't like a very special episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It was just so well done for what it was.
It was really well done.
Such great acting and such great directing, and so many surprise moments.
I mean,
and
even think about that last like 2 minutes where everybody wakes up and you see who everybody is in the framework, and just with one shot they convey. Like, I think the one that really struck my heartstrings was seeing Mac pick up a purple pink bike off of his front lawn, because to me that, like, and to anybody who was paying attention, he has the daughter that he lost in his real life, you know, and he's happy being a home family man, you know, and it's just such a nice thing. And the way he smiles when he picks it up, like, oh, that kid left it out there, but such love and care in his eyes as he picks it up and puts it back on the porch. Just that moment, it's just one shot, but it tells you so much. And they did that consistently through this entire episode with every single character. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. It was a great episode.
Show's awesome. Yeah.
It's too bad we have to wait like 2 months for
Hey, but those are the best ones, right? they whet your appetite, and then you have two episodes of Supergirl
to talk about. We have last week's episode, which was Luther's.
Yep.
And then this week's episode, which was Mr. and Mrs. Mixes Spitlick.
Mm-hmm.
So I really enjoyed both episodes. So the whole last week was all about Lena Luthor. Is she going to be evil? Is she already evil? Is she going to turn evil? Will she be convinced to be evil? I think the show did a good job balancing that, where he didn't really feel like, oh, of course she's not going to turn evil, or surprise, she's always been evil. Like, he didn't take the easy way out.
We still don't really know.
Well, you seem to think that the last scene was a bit more foreboding than I did. I just read
That's
it
so
as
funny.
She's thinking back to when she played chess with Lex as a child and all the things that entails.
I think there's more.
Oh, she's playing them like chess pieces. I'm not sure if it's necessarily that evil, but we'll see. And it's interesting to find out that she is actually Luther by blood.
Yep.
It really reminds me of the Tess character from Smallville, which basically had the same backstory, like Lionel Luther's illegitimate child who was brought back into the family, you know, after the patriarch had passed away, to sort of take over things.
Yep.
But never really felt like a Luther and tried to strike out on her own and be a good person. I like all that. There's a lot of movement on the Kara Mon-El front.
Right.
Particularly in the second episode, in the Valentine's Day episode. But by the end of the Valentine's Day episode, I'm like, okay, you know, they're getting together. I get it. But the Valentine's Day episode was all about relationships. But I do enjoy them together. I think I'm okay with the show putting them together. I mean, what I don't like is the whole will they or won't they thing when it's not done well. But I feel like the show does it pretty well so far. Like the Maggie Alex stuff is being done well. Like the Kara Mon-El stuff is being done well. I'm just happy that now this seems like they finally got together, because I wouldn't have wanted another two or three episodes of stuff continuing to pop up and preventing them from kissing for the first time, you know?
Yeah.
The Lois and Clark thing, where it's like, oh, first she has to marry Lex Luthor, and then she's replaced by a clone, and then she gets amnesia. Like, these are all literally things that happen.
I know.
So I was watching TV. That's what I want to avoid.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the Mrs. Pitlick episode was a lot of fun. What did you think of, I've forgotten the actor's name, is Peter Guido or something like that, but what did you think of the actor that they got to play
Mrs.
Pitlick
was very
non-typical Mrs. Pitlick, right? Like he's a pretty boy. He's not the short imp, the short fat imp character.
Right.
From the comics. I don't know. I mean, part of me wishes they'd done something completely off the wall and actually had like an animated character in the show. Like,
oh no,
to really
I don't know.
Be like from a different reality, like Who Framed Roger, like Who Framed Roger
that.
Rabbit style.
I could see the live action
because you can't
actor,
cast an
maybe
actor.
Like casting himself. But I could see a scenario maybe like where the live action character kind of snaps his fingers and zaps himself into a third.
I wonder if they were
going to
do that. I wonder if they're like going to have him show up and look like a crazy cartoon, only to say, "Oh, this won't work," and then like so just do it for one scene, and then he looks like a regular guy. Or have him even reference that this is not what he normally looks like, but because he's trying to woo her, he took a form that he thought would be more pleasing to her. But they didn't really do any of that. But I enjoyed it. Again, like
it was just funny.
He's definitely not the typical type.
I love his performance.
There were enough references
really...
in there to the classic Mrs. Spit, like the whole fifth dimension thing, saying the name backwards. He's looking for McGurk, you know. And we talked about how Sterling Gates co-wrote this episode, and he's a writer of the comics, and so he's throwing some comic references in there. Like John mentioned that the Zook uprising on Mars. It's like, okay. He kind of was earning his cred there. It was sweet. I follow him on Twitter, not John Jones, Sterling Gates, the writer. And he was saying like he flew back to his family's place to watch this with him because this is like his first television writing credit, you know.
That's so cool.
No, but you know, he's written dozens of comics for DC, which is no mean feat either. But I feel like for a lot of people, especially if they come up on the TV side of things, like he was Jeff Johns' kind of understudy, the way that Jeff Johns was Richard Donner's understudy. So he came up more through the film TV side of things, like Jeff Johns did, and then just happened to get into comics as Jeff Johns sort of understudy at first, and then as a writer in his own right.
Cool.
So I feel like the TV film stuff is more what he wanted to do growing up, although he also wanted to write comics, but is more what he was trained to do. And so I feel like this is a big deal for him, you know, not that writing comics wasn't, but this was something that he always wanted to do, and now he finally got to do it.
Hmm.
I think he did a great job. And the other Valentine's Day stuff, the Maggie Alex stuff was fun.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, the relationship drama is not necessarily my favorite part of these shows, but when it's done well, I enjoy it.
Yeah, I thought that this was done well.
Yeah, you wouldn't want every episode to be like, because they have done it a few times now where Maggie storms out. Right, and she's like...
Well, I mean, they did it where Alex stormed out twice and Maggie stormed out once, and now
Maggie...
Yeah, but
you see what I mean,
this is number two for Maggie.
The fact that you're keeping
count is... Exactly.
So, anyway, but I mean, I get it, but it's well done, and I feel... And I'm glad the show is continuing to advance the relationship and deal
with
these issues.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's not portrayed as being all happy all the time, especially, you know, even in our modern world, the realities of coming out and being in a gay relationship have posed their own issues.
Right.
Especially when these characters would have been growing up, you know.
Yeah, which, I mean, they're aged about at our age group, and I remember my high school experiences as a straight
I hate to tell you,
they're
supposed to be considerably younger. Like, didn't Alex say she was 27 or something? She's almost 10 years younger than us.
Hey, easy. You easy
so,
with that. No, she's only 2 years younger than me.
But I enjoyed a lot of that too, and we got to see the Fortress of Solitude again, and Mrs. Spit like pitted the big Jor-El statue against her.
Oh, that was fun.
And he got to show up in the Superman outfit, except with the big M instead of the big S.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I mean, there have been other live action versions of Mrs. Spitlick. Like I mentioned back when we first started talking about this guy's casting, that they did an episode on Smallville. Which was very different. It was kind of closer to this, and then he was like a pretty boy and didn't really have. But there, it was they played it more Smallville-like, where he didn't really have magical powers necessarily.
Right.
I think they brought him in late in one of the later seasons of Lois and Clark too. I think was he played by Howie Mandel? I think he might have been. Howie Mandel was on that show. I think he played Mrs. Spitlick.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I'm not 100% sure about that. But there have been live action versions of him before. But I feel like this is probably owing to the fact that these shows are so much more true to the spirit of the comics than most other live action versions have been.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. And the special effects can now finally allow some crazy stuff to happen on screen. This is definitely the most true to the comics version of Mrs. Spit like we've seen in live action so far. I mean, to me, like the best adaptation of him will probably always be the version from Superman the Animated Series.
Because
he looked exactly
Gilbert
like
Godfrey.
The comics and
behaved,
but I mean, if you're gonna do it in live action, this is probably the way to go.
Yep.
So I really enjoyed them.
I did too.
So this week's episode of The Flash, Attack on Gorilla City.
Oh, I've been waiting for this.
This was
one.
A lot of fun too.
Yeah.
The special effects. I mean, this was so the establishing shots of Gorilla City, the jungle,
yep.
the arena,
yep.
all that stuff was great.
I was so excited.
Some of the shots of some of the, to me, like the gorillas work great in close up.
Right.
There were some shots where you see them moving around
from like far away,
at a half distance.
Right, yeah.
And like there's something off about the movement a little bit, maybe sometimes. And I feel like Grodd being a gorilla with dark fur kind of works better on, and like the CG on Grodd was more convincing than the CG on Solovar. Maybe the white fur doesn't hide the imperfections in the model quite as much. I don't know. The Solovar stuff was less convincing to me. And every time, of course, you have the fight scene, you know it's either a CG Flash fighting a CG gorilla
right.
or a live action Grant Gustin essentially interacting with thin air,
right.
and then they put the gorilla in later.
Right.
So unless it's done perfectly, there's always sort of, you're like, it doesn't really seem like he's
I mean, I guess I wasn't looking right for way. The cracks in the armor, so for me, it was pretty fun.
Super,
it was
super ambitious. I think it's,
yes,
it's
but was.
I think that its ambition sort of outstripped its means slightly, but still, I give them credit for even doing, and I don't begrudge them doing it. I just feel like, I mean, if you want to try to do this on a TV budget, God bless you. I just feel like, you know, I feel like if this were on a movie budget,
right.
Like it would definitely have been easier.
It would be maybe like a final touch, like, because I know that the models, they have to go through many, many stages before they even look decent.
And
then even after that, the lighting has to be adjusted.
I could see in the writing,
super duper calculations.
I could see in the writing ways they were trying to keep the budget down too, like by having other characters be possessed by Grodd, so you don't have to have the Grodd model on screen for a 10-minute long scene.
Yeah.
And all the characters, all the gorillas were telepathic. Solovar was too.
Yeah, that kind of threw me for a loop.
So you didn't have to have their mouth match the words, which is very time consuming and expensive,
yes,
to match the lip flaps.
Yes.
In the comics, Grodd is the only one with telepathic powers. That's what makes him different than the other gorillas.
Yes.
But here, none of the gorillas actually had
all
to
of
talk,
them are telepathic.
So they didn't have to spend the money making the lips move. So there were a couple of scenes where I was sort of seeing the budget.
I felt a little bit cheated from that aspect,
because they have Grodd talk through Harry for 5 minutes, and then Grodd walks in at the end of the scene anyway.
Yeah.
Just to be menacing. It's like if you were right outside. They could have come in five minutes ago, but they did that so they wouldn't need to spend as much money on the CG.
I understand it, but... I mean, story-wise, I wish that they had found a different solution for that same problem, because the fact that...
Did you notice that too? That
It
happened two or three times, where then the gorilla walked in at the end of the scene anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but I'm saying, like, for me, it was a sticking point that that all of the gorillas were telepathic. Like, that doesn't make any in-world sense to me.
It didn't bother me. I only noticed it after
Sentience's
time.
Like,
wait
cool,
a minute, Solovar isn't supposed...
Exactly.
But they're also supposed to be super intelligent, and it's like in Star Trek, anytime a race becomes super intelligent, they suddenly develop mental powers, you know? It just seems like the way the
just
natural
suddenly,
evolution...
It's the Star Trek laws?
Well, how many super
First
intelligent
prime
races...
Prime directive, don't interfere.
Well, these super intelligent races
Secondary
are all,
directive... Everybody's telepathic.
The super intelligent races are always able to communicate telepathically or across great distances or whatever. It's just, you know, so the fact that they're already supposed to be super intelligent gorillas is already so ridiculous that the fact that, okay, make them telepathic too. Like, it doesn't really, it didn't bother me that much. And of course, we talked when the casting news came out, but you had apparently forgotten, as is your way, that Keith David was going to be voicing Solovar. But you
I recognized his voice immediately.
The way you reacted to his voice made me believe that you weren't expecting it, though.
Yeah.
When he walked in the room.
I kind of forgot, but I recognized and remembered immediately, so.
He was even credited with the cast along the bottom at the beginning, which characters that voice CG characters aren't normally on these shows.
Huh,
like Tony Todd was never credited as Zoom. Like
either
in the opening or in the post show credits.
Really?
And we still don't know who's playing Prometheus for the same reason. Everybody thinks it sounds like Michael Dorn, but we don't know, right? So it was actually kind of, maybe Keith David is a big enough get that they credited or they're stipulated in his contract or whatever, who knows. But he did a great job. He didn't get as much to do as I thought he would. Maybe we'll see more of him in the second episode.
We'll probably have to.
Unless Grodd just leads the army to Earth. Because now we find out that Solovar, as in the comics, Solovar is the wiser leader and Grodd is the one that wants war with humankind, despite what we were led to believe, right? Because Solovar was the one in the cartoons voiced by David Ogden Stiers, who was like a friend of the Justice League, and Grodd was always the one that was doing the evil stuff. So that was a lot of fun. It was fun seeing Harry again, having two Wells in one episode.
Yeah.
I like seeing Jesse again. Again, the CW in this show is a little bit where, like, she and Wally definitely had a connection.
Right.
They definitely had an attraction to each other. Yet now they're treating it like they've got this great star-crossed romance going on. It's like they haven't even kissed yet, and they're already
There's the always so much drama.
Yeah, there's like, I want to be with you. And I was like, go on, get coffee first. Like, you know what I mean? That they always, you know, but it seems a little over-dramatized. But I'm surprised that she's sticking. Maybe it won't happen. Maybe after this next episode, she'll have to go back to Earth 2 with her father to clean up after the grass or whatever. Maybe. And I don't mean it that way.
they've made quite a mess in that arena.
But if she does stick around, that would be surprising to me, because then you have three speedsters on the show, which I feel like, I guess, I mean, Team Arrow right now has got like six or seven people in it, but they all do like different things, kind of. It's not six guys with bows and arrows, right?
Well,
the speedsters all basically have the same powers. So I'd be surprised if they had three speedsters in every episode fighting crime. That would, to me, like Flash Kid Flash, fine. But if you have, I mean, the Flash comics, sometimes they have a bigger cast than others, but that would surprise me. So having her on Earth 2 and popping over for occasional adventures, much like, you know, Jay Garrick or whatever, I felt kind of worked well, because you bring her back when you wanted to. I'd be surprised if she stuck around, but maybe they'll do that. I don't know.
Maybe.
So the last show to talk about is Arrow, last week's episode of Arrow, which is called Spectre of the Gun.
Yes.
Speaking of episodes having topical political commentary in them. So I really enjoyed this one. We got to learn a lot about Wild Dog.
Yes.
It's kind of basically what you would... If someone had sat you down before this episode and said, imagine what Wild Dog's backstory is, I think you probably would have imagined that we knew he was ex-military. We know he had a family that's out of the picture now for whatever reason. I think you probably would have imagined that he had a wife or a kid that had died tragically in gun violence. And now he's out. Like, I think you probably would have been able to sketch it. That he came from a rough background, but pulled himself up, joined the military. Then when he got out, someone in his family died tragically. And I think you would have been able to sketch it out pretty clearly.
Yeah.
So that we got all that. There's the gun, I don't say the gun debate, although I guess it was kind of a gun debate between different characters and actually between
political
parties.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the big knock against this episode is that apparently Oliver Queen has come up with a magical, pleases everybody
kind
gun
of interim
compromise
solution.
Compromise gun bill that nobody, as is the spirit of was the thing to say about compromise, is a solution that nobody is happy with but everybody can live with,
right?
So I mean, it's but I mean, we've seen in the real world how hard it is to even come up, even to get people to compromise on gun control legislation.
Yeah,
apparently Oliver was in like a weekend was able to come up with something that everybody can live with, which,
yeah, he and Wild Dog put it together,
and we never find out what it is, which, you know, that's
that
fine.
Irks
I mean,
me a little
well,
bit
well the writers but of the show are not going to come up with some brilliant idea to control gun violence that nobody's ever thought of before, and to have them even try would seem facile. Like, you'd be like, that's ridiculous, that would never work, so better to keep it vague. I didn't have a problem with that. I did enjoy the fact that, I mean, my politics kind of lead me to see things in the episode that maybe, so I don't know, maybe I'm not the best person to say how fair they were being to both sides.
Yeah.
To me, the episode really came down on the side of there's too many guns out there, which I feel like is probably in line with the personal politics of most of the people that make the show. But I do feel like the episode definitely went out of its way to portray both sides of it. I just feel like, looking at Renee's backstory, Renee's like, man, if I'd had more guns, I could have saved my family. And I'm like, look, kid, your wife was killed. I mean, we don't need to get into the whole thing, but it's like, the criminal had a gun.
Yeah, the criminal
Wasn't it Renee's gun?
No.
What was the gun that went off? Oh, but it was because he shot the guy.
No.
He shot the guy fell, and then the guy's gun went off, and the bullet hit the wife, right? But if Renee hadn't shot him, his gun would, I mean, it could have gone down. I mean, who's to say, you know, it could have gone down a million different ways. But if
Renee's contention is that in that moment, if he had already had his weapon on him, as he had wanted to do, but his wife told him to leave it at home, if he had had it on him, he could have reacted in a moment that would have prevented everybody's death.
Yeah,
that's what his contention.
Maybe,
that's,
who
that's
knows?
His argument.
But I think the other way to look at it is that if everybody in that room hadn't had a gun, nobody would have gotten shot, right? So there's obviously
I know, and this is exactly what they were portraying. But this is exactly the discussion that they were having.
I feel like his argument was somewhat undercut when we saw the reality of the flashback, which was, because everybody started shooting with each other, that's how his wife died. You know, if she had died in a car accident or something, and his feelings about, like, I understand what they were doing, that you're right, he felt like if he had had more guns and better guns and guns all the time, then his wife wouldn't have died. But then, you know, people start to bring out the stats about how, you know, you're more likely to shoot a family member than you are an intruder and all this other stuff. Like, so his, he had definitely had his, to me, it seemed like his narrow perspective on things. Like, if we had had more guns, then only the bad people would be, are going to die if everybody has guns, right? Which to me seems
ridiculous.
This
is exactly, I mean, that's the argument that he makes, but he is it really stems from that scene that we saw. And that moment, that regret that was expressed, that in that moment, if he had had it behind his belt already, instead of having it locked up in the safe and not there in time.
I understand. I just, what I saw in that scene was people started shooting at each other and surprise, surprise, somebody innocent got caught in the crossfire, which is what always happens, you know?
Yeah.
So that's me bringing my own personal, you know, politics to it. I could see how someone who felt the opposite way would come away thinking that.
And that's why I think this episode is really good, because
to me, the way Renee came out of it seemed incredibly naive to me, that, or maybe even the opposite of naive. I don't know, whatever, you know, it seemed incredibly simplistic of him to think that if he had had, you know, but I could see how someone on the opposite side of it would have.
Exactly. That's what I think this episode did really well, is that they wrote both sides of the argument, and that no matter what, people know that something needs to be done because people are still dying.
I guess,
but the how is really.
I guess my only complaint would be that you had the episode positioned Curtis and Renee on like opposite sides.
Yes.
And Felicity is someone who just didn't want to have the debate.
Yeah.
And Oliver is someone who wanted to hear all perspectives so that he could.
So all four. So that corners that was of this
fine,
entire issue
but
have
I,
been represented.
Bringing my knowledge of Green Arrow to the table, he's such a, like you're seeing now in the comics that you're reading right now, like he's such a lefty that, and you don't need to make him exactly like he is in the comics. And I understand this is a show marketed to a broad audience and he's the star of the show.
Yep.
And if his personal politics tick off too many people, you're going to lose viewers. You're going to lose advertisers. Like I get it. And maybe like Stephen Amell's personal politics don't enter into it too. I have no idea what his political affiliation is. Who knows? But for whatever reason, they wrote Oliver as being like right down the middle on this, almost to a ridiculous degree. Like you've talked about, like he's able to satisfy everybody.
But this was really another nice point too, is that they represented his plight as a legislator and a mayor.
I like seeing him struggle with it, but I wish he'd come down more on one side or the other, even if it was the side I disagree with, because I felt like he was almost unrealistically centrist on the whole thing. And the gun debate these days is such a hot button.
Finding that miraculous.
So polarized that the idea that someone, especially someone who's been through such extreme life events, such extreme violence, people that he loves being killed. Granted, a lot of them were killed by swords, not by guns, but some of them were killed by guns.
Right.
Someone who's been through the crazy life that he has, the idea that he doesn't have a strong position on what causes people and enables people to commit acts of violence.
Right.
To me seems almost staggeringly unrealistic. Even though personally, knowing that the character in the comics would think, he'd be like, look, give everybody bows and arrows if you want, but nobody should have any guns. That would be Green Arrow from the comics. nobody gets any guns, right?
Yeah.
Like that's Green Arrow, because he's the most leftist character in the DC universe. If they wanted to flip the script a little bit and have him be like, look, I've killed people before, I understand that sometimes people need to take things into their own hands, and so I'm okay with people having guns. Like, to me, that would not be a very Green Arrow thing to do, but I could buy the show's version of Green Arrow, who has taken lives and done extreme things, would lean more towards that affiliation. I could have bought it either way. But the fact that they tried to have it both ways and neither way, to me, was kind of soured me on it a little bit. But I still felt that that it was admirable to tell the story.
Yes.
I did think it was a well-told story. I think it was brave to try to tell that kind of story on a CW superhero show.
Yeah.
And to actually have a scene where someone breaks into the mayor's office and murders people.
Yeah.
And then they're not some supervillain. They're not some, not even.
They're just a person like suffering
from trauma.
It's just
a guy. He's not even some crazy gun nut or terrorist or weird, you know, separatist guy or whatever.
Yep.
He's just a guy who lost his family. And of course, the guy's motivations make no sense. But this, oftentimes people lose their minds, you know, when their families are killed and their motivations start making no sense. But the idea that this guy's family was killed in gun violence and therefore he's going to kill other people. Like, obviously that makes zero sense.
No. He took it out on the mayor's office because he felt one way about the legislation not going through.
I'm just pointing out the obvious thing, which is
That well, I mean, he wasn't
you,
like...
Your life was destroyed because your family was killed, and so now you're going to kill other people and take them away from their families obviously makes no sense.
But this is like this is the part that's trauma-induced.
Well, I understand how someone could be brought to that by trauma.
Yeah, but I don't want to leave the conclusion that, oh, he's just bat crap crazy. Like,
no,
that's not...
I'm just saying, like, they probably could have... I mean, this is... I'm sure that people have that kind of reaction in the real world.
Yeah, the motivations were pretty clear.
But the motivations, again, were a little, like, that's a little easy, right? Like, his family,
sure,
like, his family was taken by gun violence, and now he's going to go out there and kill. Like, to me, like, that was a little two-dimensional to me, but it was there to enable the broader debate. And so, and I feel like it did that. So, yeah, I think it was, I was seeing people say, oh, this is like a landmark episode. This is a special, the whole thing is here is like on a very special episode. I'm not sure where that comes from, but you know, special episode. I feel like that was maybe overselling it a bit because it didn't. To me, to earn that, it would have needed to take like a strong stance, which it didn't. But I do still feel like it was a valiant effort.
Right.
And I really did enjoy it as an episode, too. I think that someone pointed out that he doesn't actually suit up as Green Arrow in the whole episode.
Yeah.
Which I didn't even notice watching it.
I was about to tell you that
I'm
wasn't like
I'm not sure if that's
like
the first
Arrow
time or not, but it's... But he said, and actually I was reading an interview with Stephen Amell where he said he's happy that the show has gotten to a place where you can have episodes where he doesn't suit up or whatever because the show has developed his life outside of the costume, especially
character
recently
work.
With the mayor's office
exactly.
and the supporting characters that he's involved with there and all the other stuff. You can have an episode where they don't quote-unquote fight crime or get into costume and you don't even notice it.
Yep.
Like, I think this show can get away with that a bit more than, say, Supergirl.
Yeah.
And you could do a great episode of Supergirl where she never puts on the costume, and maybe one day they will. But I feel like this show being more down to earth and also being in its fifth season has kind of gotten works better for where the show is than it would for, say, Flash or Supergirl. Can you imagine an episode of Legends of Tomorrow where they don't travel through time or fight anybody? Like,
well,
that would
I
seem-
mean... Traveling through time is pretty much the premise of their entire show.
Well, sure, but shooting people with bows and arrows is the premise of Arrow, too, and he didn't do any of that in this episode, right? That's my whole point.
Mm,
so I'm just saying, I mean, obviously he did, quote-unquote, stop crime, you know, in this episode.
Yeah, he stopped crime. He stopped crime good.
But yeah, so I don't know. So it was definitely an interesting episode and an interesting
I like it. I like it for the ambition that it undertook. I like it for the character work, and I like it for, I don't know, just they did a good job. You know, they didn't pick a side, sure, but they covered as much of the issue as they possibly could, and I don't think they offended anybody. I really think they really did a nice job writing the arguments well, and I like the character work because, to me, it felt completely natural that Rene would argue the side that he argued, that Curtis would argue the side that he argued, that Felicity
really, it was
would
just
want
Oliver
to
that
focus
I,
on the work.
It was really just Oliver that I felt like I didn't completely buy their personal perspective.
Yeah, Oliver, you know, the legislator, he's still figuring stuff out.
What it reminded me of was the episode of Legends of Tomorrow from like a month ago, which dealt with slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was similar. Like, they definitely, not sugarcoated it, but they didn't really go into it the way that you would if you were like an HBO drama or something. It was definitely kind of a surface level, like high school history level reading of the subject. But still, I felt like they treated it with the proper, as with the slavery episode. I call it the slavery episode as if that's what the episode was about. But you know the one I'm talking about. Right?
Yeah,
okay.
Of course.
Give me a look.
Of course, no.
To me,
I was trying to remember the title.
So,
of the
I mean, they definitely didn't delve into the issue in the way that other shows might be allowed to do. But to me, in both cases, it reminded me of that because it feel like they treated it with the proper deference.
Yes.
You know, and it handled it with seriousness and in a way that is, you know, important for pop culture to constantly be discussing.
Yes, and
reminding
consider,
people
yeah,
that
exactly.
this is the thing.
Yeah.
You know, even though it didn't really go as far as other shows might, or that the subject perhaps needs to be taken in order to progress things, but that's not necessarily the job of these shows. And they don't need, you know, these shows don't need to do episodes like this. But like we talked about with...
Well, it didn't really... I mean, it's a time-traveling show, so it didn't have like a super, like a six-episode arc to delve into the issues. It was more about like, okay, this is the topic of the history that we're addressing, but also it's in this climate and we're going to pay the correct respect to the actual climate surrounding and the setting in which this was all taking place, because otherwise it won't make sense. And number two, we're not shying away from the horrors of this time.
It's like I said about the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. thing. Like, I'm sure any political commentary they do this season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
This is not going to be some great, insightful, Nobel Peace Prize winning treatise on world affairs. But
yeah.
But it's the not duty necessarily, but it's an important part of the history of these universes and these franchises and these characters that they have been often political.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Marvel Comics universe was founded on, you know, World War II, and then later on like, you know, hippie culture, drug culture, you could even say in the 60s with Doctor Strange, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Or some prominent Spider-Man stories dealt with drugs. I mean, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow storyline, the whole hard traveling heroes thing with Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, where Green Lantern and Green Arrow traveled across America, and they did episodes that dealt with religion and the plight of Native Americans, and the one where Speedy was on drugs, right? The classic cover that everybody's seen, and Green Lantern, I hear you work for the blue skins, but how come you've never done nothing for the black skins, right? All that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, these going back 30 years, 40 years to that, and even further back to when the characters were created in World War II, and even before that, they've mm-hmm. always had, both Marvel and DC, have always had a history of very pointed political commentary, which would almost seem startling to a modern audience, how pointed their political commentary. Like, Captain America was literally punching Hitler.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
not I saw that cover.
Too many analogies today, but can you imagine if DC Comics, owned by, you know, Time Warner and Warner Brothers, one of the biggest, most prominent corporations in America, did a cover where Superman was punching some prominent politician?
No.
Can you imagine the crap storm that would rain down on them, right?
Yeah.
Like, people would be putting bombs in their mail, you know? It would be insane.
Yeah.
And yet this was the stuff that the creators were doing
back
almost
then.
80 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's just, I rant about it, but you do see sometimes, get this politics stuff out of my TV shows and out of my, well, no, you know, popular culture reflects the discourse that we're having in our society. And these characters have always been a reflection of our aspirations and our best impulses and our worst impulses the stories have been a way of playing out like morality plays, right? Like the conflicts that we're having in our society are reflected in the conflicts the characters are having. Not always. Sometimes it's just Superman fighting a mad scientist or whatever.
Yeah.
But in their best moments when they strive for something more, they can have real power as art. And I feel like shows on CW are not necessarily always striving to be high art,
yep.
but that doesn't mean that they can't try to actually do something important with their stories in addition to entertaining people.
Yep.
So I said my piece about that.
Yeah, that's good. Did we finish talking about all our shows?
Yes, we have.
Oh, well, if you would like to join the conversation, we have several avenues through which you can do so. First off, our email address is mailbag@smartspodcast.com. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com. Our Twitter handle is @smartspodcast. And our Facebook page is facebook.com/smartspodcast. Yay. How about a funny sound for us?
Your turn.
It is? Ooh, I did not prepare. How about...
Ooh.